Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle, and this is a very special episode of the podcast, so we're going to get right into it. This is a topic that we touch on and off here on the show. I wanted to have an expert on to talk about the relationship between Christianity and libertarianism, because I feel that the atheist wing of the libertarian movement is very well represented. And many on our audience are Christians who want to know more about it. And there's a great organization called the Libertarian Christian Institute, run by a fellow named Norman Horn, who is on the line with me now. Norman, how are you today?
I'm doing wonderful, Chris. Thanks for having me on your show today.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out. Like I said, I'm excited to have this conversation because I think there are a lot of misconceptions about the relationship between politics and religion and how that would function in a free society. So I look forward to the conversation that we're going to have today. And I want to start with you and how you got started. How did you become first a Christian and then a libertarian?
Cool. I can totally tell you all about that. First of all, I really did grow up in a Christian household and have a fairly sizable Christian heritage, if you will, and mostly in the so-called Churches of Christ, part of the Stone Campbell Restoration movement that started up in kind of the 19th century, but really is a unification movement, if you will, for all Christians to be a part of. That's trying to unify, in a sense, behind the idea that we are Christians first, even if we're not the only Christians around, and so it really tries to focus on the primacy of Scripture and utilizing that to the best extent we can to act like the Christians of the first century and really recapture this aspect of early Christendom and what the early Christians were like, because they had the most direct model to Jesus that was at the time, that they had the apostles' example to follow, and so that that's something that we're trying to sort of recapture in that. But I've got a lot of friends in a lot of different denominations though, and my wife comes from a Presbyterian background. So I love the church, and I think it's the most important institution in the history of the world. And in fact, that's part of the reason why I'm a libertarian, in a sense, is to really say that the church is what needs to be the best culture influencing institution around us.
Yeah, there seems to be a move away from hierarchical organizations more towards, the Christianity of Acts, essentially. It's funny you mentioned that because, we've seen, obviously, out of the Catholic Church into a ton of denominations, and then you had more of the structured or religious organizations all the way to there was one day where I went from a Catholic mass and then went to a mega church, like back-to-back in one day.
Oh, wow.
And so the juxtaposition between, even the Vatican II mass right into the baby boomer mega church, you're like, wow, this is a complete rebellion of what they were raised in. And it seems like in the millennial generation, you have a lot more of, tribal churches, smaller churches that seem to be a little bit closer to what we saw. And I think that fits really well with libertarianism because libertarianism, as much as we, bag on communism, it really is about small communities, and the end result of pure libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism, in my opinion, is organizing yourself in a way very much like Acts.
There's a lot of truth to that, I think. The efficacy of denominations as a whole is just interesting because a lot of us do have, slightly differing opinions on how we prefer to worship, on certain types of doctrines, and yet we all kind of agree about so many fundamental things that, it's a good idea sometimes to have at least a little bit of space so that you can, be close when you need to be close and distance when you need to be slightly distanced in order to minimize conflicts. That's actually quite a libertarian thing when you think about it.
Right. Absolutely. So let's continue on your story. Let's talk about how you discovered a little bit about libertarianism. I mean, were you born a libertarian or did you have
well,
a great
in,
awakening?
In a manner of speaking, I suppose. I think it really starts in, if you will, in my teenage years, in the mid 90s, my family started homeschooling. Which was we had never really been in public schools, but it was kind of a revelation to us as to what we, what we could do on our own versus with the kind of tacit influence, even the private school systems are very, you know, influenced by the public school institution that we have in the United States. I mean, that's just a fact. So once you exit that entirely, things begin to look a little different. And in fact, there are, you know, even in back in the 90s, despite the you know, the religious influence of early homeschooling, let's put it, the religious influence in early homeschooling people was very, very high. And that's different now than it was then. But there was still very much a libertarian streak, though most of the people even then would have really considered themselves more of the conservative variety, especially in politics. As an undergrad student in the early 2000s, though, I began to kind of discover a few things here and there. I actually discovered Ron Paul back in, I think it was, I want to say it was 2002. It may have been 2003. I can't even remember what the website was and the party name. It was not the Libertarian Party at the time. But it had this, you know, notion that, oh, we should get back on the gold standard. And it was proposing that Ron should run for president with Walter Williams as the vice president nominee. It was kind of funny, you know, thinking in retrospect. But it was, you know, because both excellent men, of course. But, you know, that was a early exposure. And then when I got involved with the girl who would eventually be my wife, her dad got me on to reading some articles from the Mises Institute. And even though my father-in-law, a wonderful, wonderful man, is not really a hardcore libertarian, he gets a lot of his economic views from kind of a libertarian perspective, and kind of is a Friedmanite, if you will.
We need to get him right out. We can't have that sort of thing around here.
Well, you know, Milton had his virtues as well, right. and certainly helps out a lot of people along the pathway towards learning about liberty in a great sense, and that's a good thing. So he got me into reading these articles from LVMI, and I just kind of got hooked. And I was just a young engineer at the time. I was studying chemical engineering and at university, and so I was thoroughly ensconced in the science. But even back in, you know, doing my economics classes, I wasn't exactly thrilled at what I was learning. It all sounded a little weird. So when I started learning, you know, real economics, I began to really like move in my own brain towards a new way of thinking. And then in early graduate school at UT Austin, I remember my wife and I, we had been married for, I don't remember, couldn't have been even more than about 6 months. And I remember putting down, you know, my laptop and saying like, okay, I've just realized that every argument that I have in favor of conservatism is actually better answered by liberty and libertarian ideas. I don't think I can really be a conservative anymore. And so we had this discussion, and then I started talking to my parents about it a little bit, and there was some resistance on their end at first, but then when I kind of explained to them that, you know, all these things that you taught me before about the problems in government and the wastefulness and evils of the Civil War, even not because the South was right, but because why should people in the same country like that be fighting against each other? This is insane. When you know, they ended slavery in England without firing a shot, and realizing that, you know, Christians shouldn't behave like that. And I told them, like, look, I'm just doing what you taught me to do, just more consistently.
Sure.
And they thought about that for a second and went, oh, okay. And now they're two of the biggest supporters of LCI, even the Libertarian Christian Institute. To fast forward a couple of years from there, later on, I did like Mises University, and did some publishing in the space. Published a peer-reviewed article on liberty ideas in pollution control and stuff like that. Some really weird stuff. And started, you know, doing a lot of writing in a secondary space, which was the intersection of libertarian ideas and Christian theology. Because at the same time as I'm going through my graduate work in chemical engineering, I began to do a little bit of graduate work here and there in theology at a seminary in Austin, Texas that my family has a relationship with, and my church had a relationship with, so they let me take a class a semester there, pretty much, you know, just however I wanted to do it. And so I ultimately ended up getting a master's in theology along the way with my PhD in engineering. So I started, you know, applying my theological training to understanding how this intersection of, you know, Christian thought and libertarian philosophy. that really started sparking a lot of interesting research venues and pathways. And eventually I got to the point where I'd written so much stuff even on my own. I thought, I need to do something with this. I need to put some of this out there. So I started a website in late 2008, pretty much right after Obama got elected. It was late November in 2008 when I started libertarianchristians.com. And it was really just meant to be a blog where I would just put down stuff that I felt was, important for understanding Christianity and liberty. And it just kept growing and growing. It had a good following. It's small following. It's pretty niche when you start thinking about it, of course. And, the church in and of itself doesn't tend to just grab an immediate hold of libertarian ideas, despite being, fairly favorable in kind of the philosophical sense toward it. And so it kept growing, and I got a lot of interesting attention from people and became kind of a bit of a leader in that community there, and started a massive Facebook group that now has over the course of years, it now has over 8,000 people in it. And then eventually we turned it into a nonprofit in 2015, where we decided that we were going to turn it into a nonprofit. So we started the Libertarian Christian Institute there and got our 501c3 status in what amounts to be record time. I'm told that and I have like physical evidence of the determination letter, which basically based on the postmark based on when I sent it versus when I got the termination letter. It took them 2 weeks to give it to us.
Wow. It took me 8 months once, which I thought was quick. I mean, some that'll take years.
If you know Alexander McCobin at Students for Liberty, a wonderful guy who's actually on our board as a strategic member, he to help give us some guidance here and there. He says if there's any reason to believe in God, this should be it.
Well, apparently, Lois Lerner was not at the IRS at that point, and
yes, this was post that point.
Yep,
for
just
sure.
Stamped you right on through. That's great.
I guess so.
So what sort of? Go ahead, continue on with the story.
I do think that perhaps one reason why that it probably got expedited through was because we kind of classify. We thought about this a lot actually, and we kind of classify in the IRS as a religious organization. So I think that may have helped us, but nonetheless, that's pretty awesome. So
what sort of work does the Libertarian Christian Institute do?
So following in kind of the tradition of what I was doing with libertarianchristians.com, our mission is ultimately to equip the church to promote a free society. In other words, we care about promoting libertarian ideas to the church itself, while we are, of course, wanting to reach as many libertarians as we can and show them that, we are on board with the libertarian philosophy. We understand its importance, and we agree that it is a way that we can act at peace with everyone. Our primary mission is to really talk to the church as an organization. But we do, like I said, we'd love to talk to other libertarians. And in fact, we do upon occasion and in a little surprising way, there are some people who actually become Christians in part because of the influence that we have been able to help bring forward, which is really exciting for us. And it's sort of the unintended consequence, to borrow from another famous economist for a moment, of doing something like this. It's pretty cool. So we just try to produce materials and articles, videos, podcasts, book length stuff, even as best we can, in order to help educate Christians and equip you as a libertarian who's also a Christian to go and talk to the church about being in a free society.
Do you find that also part of your work? Because my story is basically I was an atheist Republican, and then around 9/11, I ended up becoming a Christian shortly after that because of personal and global reasons. And then, a few years later, ended up becoming a libertarian just a couple years after that. So then I became a Christian libertarian. I did spend, and I have found that my working through libertarianism really did help me in a lot of ways with my faith, and vice versa. Being a Christian really helped me shape my libertarian identity, where empathy is a huge part of what I try to preach here on the show, is that we have to have empathy for other people, and that is just directly tied to my Christian beliefs. But do you find a lot of your work is people like yourself? I have this bucket of ideas, and I'm helping Christian libertarians kind of reconcile, because, you know, when I was a Republican, even though I was an atheist, I was, you know, the home of Christians was the Republican Party. And then right. you become, I talked to so many people when I was executive director of the Libertarian Party, especially here in Indiana, who said, I would become a libertarian, but you guys don't believe in any kind of religion. you guys are libertines, basically. And I think we do ourselves no favors, which I'll ask you a little bit more about this later, when we sure. are constantly preaching, everybody can just do what they want. And that kind of reinforces that notion that Republicans are the home of Christians. So is a lot of your work the reconciliation of those two belief systems?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure I'd even call libertarianism really a belief system. If it is a belief system, it's incredibly incomplete. And I look at worldviews as something that has to provide a more holistic look at the entire world. I think if anything, you know, libertarian philosophy is limited in scope, as we like to say, mm-hmm. and really addresses, you know, your listeners know that libertarianism tries to address the proper use of force and violence in society, if there is any at all. And how does that play out in various spheres of influence, whether that is we're thinking about the state or whether we're thinking about just legality or how we deal with legal type issues, and especially around the use of property rights as being supreme in how we treat that, those sorts of things. That reconciling Christianity with that is not really, I mean, if anything, they're not antagonistic at all. It's really misperceptions that cause people to question whether liberty is, in fact, the proper mode of action for or proper way of organizing society, rather than, you know, something else. Whether that being some sort of authoritarian streak from a state or the authoritarian streak of an aberrant view in a church, for that matter. I think that's the way, you know, we kind of approach it there, for sure.
But let me play John Stossel here, but isn't religion and Christianity specifically just another oppressive belief system? And libertarians are all about freedom. So how can you advocate for religion in any kind of free society?
Well, that'd be very funny to really, you know, take that to its logical conclusion if you really believe that, since it was Christians who really were, you know, quite influential in bringing forward liberty ideas in the West in the first place. And so that's sort of a non sequitur when we start looking at history, that it was Christians who really pushed that forward. Now, incompletely, for sure. It was not understood perfectly by any means, and there are, you know, we can indict our forefathers in the faith even for some of those things, but recognizing that they were on the right path and that we have – it's our responsibility to improve upon their foundation as well. So, you know, that's – I think that's one way to sort of answer that from a more historical point of view. The second one is that doesn't really follow from what we learn in the scriptures and from the person of Jesus, who was absolutely about setting people free. Now, free from what, mind you? Free from sin, and by freeing oneself from sin and being able to commit oneself to the person and model of Christ, you ultimately end up with perfect liberty as a result of that. In that, even while in chains, you can have the Christians like Paul and the other apostles who were imprisoned, truly believing that they were indeed ultimately free, even while in chains. Now, that's sort of a, you know, kind of a parallel thought about what freedom means in this instance, but they're also very much related. And that, you know, kind of like you remember in V for Vendetta, for instance, that the movie where, you know, once the protagonist realizes that, you know, she can no longer be influenced or oppressed anymore by the torture and whatnot that's been going on to her. She says, then you truly are free. It's kind of a similar thing in a sense that by, you know, by committing to one to those higher values, and in this case, being committed to the person and model of Christ, that we truly attain freedom that goes beyond even that which we might call political freedom.
Well, I think in my specific case, Matthew 6, where he talks about anxiety and living in the moment. Jesus talks about living in the moment and anxiety. And, you know, why are you worrying? The birds of the air don't worry about things. And he's basically teaching live more in the present and stop worrying about the future. Stop thinking about the past. Just look at the people in front of you and love the people that are in front of you and deal with the reality. And to me, that was a point of personal freedom that I would not have attained had I not had a religious structure in my life to, you know, be it the Bible or the church or this entire belief system for me to kind of compare my reality, my world, my belief system, my life, my, you know, personal thoughts to. I wouldn't have that point of freedom.
That's right. And that kind of goes to the point that liberty and it happens on a bunch of different levels. Libertarianism really addresses part of it. But in a sense, one might even be able to argue that you're not in a sense a full libertarian until you are fully free. And I would add that like that would mean being part of the in part and being sorry, let me rephrase that. That would mean being in Christ, as the Apostle Paul writes. And so that ultimately is like what kind of transforms us by the renewing of our minds constantly into more and more like Christ. That's thrilling when you think about it, even from a libertarian perspective. You know, as Christians, we understand how important that is, but then kind of take a step back and just go with it from that libertarian point of view for just a moment. You're like, wow, that's kind of neat to think about.
Well, when people, going back to the John Stossel question, people look at the whole of the church or maybe even one specific person that they had a bad experience with. But if you look at people like Martin Luther, for instance, Martin Luther had very libertarian tendencies in fighting. I mean, he stood up to, was it King Charles? He stood up to the Pope of the time. I mean, he basically took on all these various power structures and said, no, as an individual, I have the right to do this, and they are individuals, and they have the inherent right to read the scriptures for themselves. So you have these great libertarian-leaning heroes through the church.
Oh, definitely.
And as you pointed out, monasteries through the Dark Ages really kept all this ancient wisdom afloat. I mean, they kept it hidden and secretive, and it was carried through a lot of the monasteries throughout the world. So religion has done a lot of good in the world, and I think it sometimes gets a bad rap.
Oh yeah, definitely. And that's not to say that there aren't problems in the church today, and some heinous ones at that. But as I'd like to say, you know, if we're just hypocrites anyway, where else are we supposed to go than the church?
Yeah,
because it's where we got to go to receive nourishment to fix that, if you will.
So. Yeah, to that point, I mean, the church was at the forefront. Yes, the scriptures were used by some people to justify African slavery in America, but it was true Christians who were really leading the fight for abolition in this country. It's Christian organizations today who are fighting to end sex slavery in our time.
Right.
And that really goes to sort of my next question that you kind of alluded to, but something that I've been thinking through that I don't necessarily have the language to fully articulate. Maybe you can help me kind of flush this out a little bit. So conservatism in a lot of ways is libertarianism with the belief that you have to support a moral structure in society or else it falls apart. Like I listen to Ben Shapiro every day. I think Ben Shapiro is very sharp. He has some atrocious beliefs about things like foreign policy and immigration and other things. But he does articulate his point of view very well in that you do have to have a religious set of institutions to help move some things in society forward. And I hear libertarians say, no, that's not the case. We just need the absence of all institutions. We need anarchy for society to flourish. And I think they don't really necessarily have their point very well thought out because they don't understand the nature of human beings. We're going to collect into institutions no matter what. Eventually, it's like, how do you arrange it? And so there is a debate between conservatives and libertarians over the history of our existence, especially over the 20th century, of how much should your moral beliefs influence your political beliefs? How much should your religion, it's like, how much peanut butter should you get in your chocolate? and And in a purely anarchist society, I don't necessarily think that it would be every... I think we sometimes think about it as every individual becomes their own self-government, and it's a vacuum, a total absence of cooperation with other people, at least in the way that a lot of people express it on Facebook. Now, if you go to like the Mises Institute, it's a lot more fleshed out, right? What is the relationship that you see of religious institutions in an anarchic... And I don't know if you're an anarcho-capitalist.
I am. That's fine.
Right. So what role do religious institutions play in an anarcho-capitalist society?
Well, let me kind of back up and say, like, this is related to our organization as well, that we actually have in our core values, and you can find all of this in our if you just go to libertarianchristians.com/mission, you can find our core values that we've recently kind of published and are pushing pretty hard here these days. One of those is that we want to make very clear that we believe that social institutions really do matter for human flourishing. The reason we say that social institutions really do matter for human flourishing is for the simple reason that humans are social beings. That's what we were created to be. We were not created to live out as hermits and be atomists, but rather to work together and develop these kinds of institutions. Now, that those look in, you know, in a variety, it look like a variety of different things. The most basic one being the family. And anybody who says that, you know, libertarian or not, who thinks that the family should be abolished for any reason is out of their freaking minds, and you should run the other direction because that's just crazy. If they want to live on their own and do their own thing is, you know, because they're libertarians, fine. But that's not the way that society is meant to be structured. Families are important. And then building up from there, we have other types of institutions, businesses, neighborhood associations, even to a certain extent, as bad as they can be sometimes. But these institutions that we build up, which would also include the voluntary organization that is the church, these are meant to be formed in peaceful, non-coercive ways, because that's just the way that humans were meant to interact together. And when humans interact together at all, suddenly, you know, there's going to be the possibility and incentive to create institutions in order to even, for instance, reduce transaction costs, because it's better sometimes to be in institutions than to be alone. That's just a fact. And so liberty doesn't need to discourage this by any means. Pleasant, in fact, and in fact, there's church and knowledge and things that have been written about the importance of social institutions for preserving culture and preserving liberty. These are important things, and that's really when it comes down to it, to being authentically human.
Absolutely, and I think the issue is that institutions will build up and over time become corrupt, and you need to be able to break them apart very quickly and easily and fragment into something that works differently and works better. And I think if you look at the church specifically, you had the Catholic Church, which maintained its position of power by force for many decades. And now you have denominations where they're constantly breaking apart and spiraling off into different directions. You know, the United Methodist Church, of which I was raised in, you know, there is an organization that was formed. It's the United Methodist because it came out of, I think it was the Evangelical Brethren and the Methodist, and then they formed this basically super band of denominations. Yeah. And now it's at the point where it's looking like it's going to break apart again over gay pastors, essentially. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Nobody, you know, one segment of the United Methodist Church is not going to use guns to force the other segment to stay in the actual agreement. Whereas with government, you have inherent force. And so you have a distinct difference there in the way that those... So libertarians often argue that structures... I argue that institutions like the family, like religious institutions, for instance, these are not bad things. These are just going to exist no matter what. It's when we start using force that it becomes the true issue, and that's why we need to move away from structuring society with government.
Yeah, I believe, in fact, that really one of the worst things to truly ever happen to the church universal... And this includes the Catholic Church and everything, was the unification of throne and altar through Constantine. And that was terrible, because suddenly this fringe movement, if you will, of Christians now suddenly had political power possibilities. And that just grew and grew and grew into a more and more terrible thing. And it really took the Reformation to kind of begin to pull back the brakes on such. And that was really important, both for the, you know, what ended up being the Protestantism and for the Catholic Church too. It was really important to for them to be getting backed off on as well. So, I mean, that was really, the Reformation was great for everybody in this respect. And so that's, I think that's really critical to remember, is that some of the things that really we can indict the church for, really happens when you have when you had that unification of throne and altar, and the usage of the church as, you know, from a state point of view was a really bad thing.
Well, I think, and many people, in a silly fashion, are against, you know, anybody who is a Christian using their belief system to inform their politics. And then they cite things that happened in like 1300.
Yeah, right.
And you're just like, okay, that was like 1500 years ago. Get over it. But what what do you think, what would you say to those people who say, oh, well, you're just a Republican in sheep's clothing. If you're a Christian and you're a libertarian, then you're basically just trying to turn this into a Republican light party because you're just a Dominionist who is basically trying to.
That's insane.
Yeah. Well, all right. So how does your personal belief system inform your politics and individual issues?
Everywhere, in so many respects. But it's really the way I would describe it, though, is that my Christian faith and libertarian ideas are concordant together. That is to say that what I am understanding about the way things are in the world, based from a natural rights, natural law point of view, from understanding economics and all of these things that are not laid out in full in the Bible, even the ethics that we understand from natural law, limited in scope as they are concordant with that which we learn from Scripture. The non-aggression principle, for instance, that aggression should be prohibited, that the initiation of force is wrong, is something that we can see in Scripture from a variety of different points, throughout the Bible. And sometimes it's expressed in different ways, but it's alluded to in so many ways, from thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not murder to even thou shalt not covet. And then, you know, you see the flip side of the non-aggression principle in kind of the golden rule, and working together, these two things provide a fairly comprehensive ethic. That is that, you know, the non-aggression principle saying that you shouldn't do unto others what you don't want done to you, in a sense. The golden rule states that you should do unto others what you would want done to you. So in a way, that provides the double-sided ethic, and so the two sides of a coin, if you will, that from the negative right standpoint says this is what you shouldn't do to others, period. And that becomes the basis of what is legal, if you will. But then there's a higher calling that we shouldn't force upon others per se. It's not something that we can require others to do, but God calls us as Christians to do something a little higher, if you will, or more. And that is that we should be looking to do to others and to help others in the way that we would want to be treated. To treat others the way we'd want to be treated is a great thing. And that takes a little bit of an additional commitment, if you will, to an ethic. But it's more than libertarianism per se, but it doesn't go against it either. So that's important to kind of realize here. And going back to another part of your question, though, is that, you know, you kind of said, why would a libertarian say, like, well, why aren't you just Republicans light here? Well, the answer to that comes in the same, just in what we were saying here. It's like, we are committed to the non-aggression principle and doing that consistently, which means that you commit yourself to the Republican Party's ultimate values, which require you, or at least, to have some sort of commitment to statism as a whole. Now, if there's some nuance there, we could say that, you know, like Ron Paul does in participating in the Republican Party in order to enhance liberty in the world today and to reduce statism. Like, I understand that, and that's important. I don't want to discount that. But recognizing where we ultimately stand from this ethical standpoint is important.
Kind of skipping back there, you really kind of smash in that little bit of the beef against libertarianism is that it's all about selfishness and it's all about materialism. And I think Ayn Rand did the libertarian movement a disservice in a lot of ways by promoting the virtue of selfishness because I think to especially many people on the left, libertarians are just selfish people who just want to get rich and they want to, you know, build their own Somalia and then, you know, enslave people, which is
Somalia,
right? Which is not the case at all. I think part of why I hate the growth of the welfare state is that it has atrophied the church in its, you know, 100 years ago, you had systems of, you know, the Salvation Army, the Red Cross. You had all of these civic organizations who did a lot of things that, you know, modern welfare state would do, but they did it better and they did it with a human face and it wasn't a bureaucracy and there wasn't as much waste and Christians were more engaged, Jews and Muslims and atheists were more engaged in helping people who are less fortunate. If you remove the welfare state, you end up with a more generous society, and as of now, everybody's sort of stringing it, trying to make ends meet, and they don't have the time to go out and give as much as they could or should. So I think a libertarian society is a much more generous society, and it completely defeats the notion of a selfish. The virtue of selfishness is a tenet of libertarianism.
You know, there's so many things that you said there I kind of want to touch on in a comment here. Going back, you said something very early when we started this conversation that, you know, atheists seem to be very well represented in the libertarian movement. And part of the reason why I kind of tried to take it on myself to promote these Christian libertarian ideas was that I could see, even before I'd ever started anything with LCI or LCC at the time, that there were plenty of Christians in the libertarian movement. And it wasn't that we were not plentiful. It's just that it wasn't that the voices weren't there, but that the other voices, the atheist voices, sometimes were rather overpowering.
And yes, let's use the
rather that overwhelming.
That was a very Christian way to say that.
Yeah. Well, and that's not to I think it's worthwhile to, you know, recognize the positive things that even Ayn Rand did for us as libertarians. I mean, she didn't even like libertarians, didn't think that it, you know, that we had a very good philosophy, always thought it was way too incomplete and that her way of thinking was totally the right way of going about it. But she did have some really good things to say and some things that, you know, in many respects, Christians should embrace on some level, not necessarily everything by any means. One of them, which I love, that one of the favorite thing that she said that I like to quote is she says that the moral is the practical. That is eminently obvious to libertarians, and it should be eminently obvious to Christians as well. But sometimes they forget this. And they think that, well, there's just enough bad people in this world that it is important that we go on military adventurism and make sure that we're making the world safe for democracy and things like that, as if that's a good idea. But, you know, what Christians have always tried to say, or should be saying at least, and is that, you know, you can't accomplish good through evil means. By no means should we ever say that. That's something that the Book of Romans makes very clear. That was something that was scandalously said about that Christians might believe at the time. And by no means should we ever try to do evil that good may result. That makes a lot of sense, even from just thinking about basic theology, and that the way that God created the world was to be a win-win situation for us, is that through cooperation, through voluntary efforts, through things like trade and voluntary association, we're able to enhance our state of being, to bring good things into the world, and provide for those who are potentially less fortunate, and to just to live and flourish in this way. That is in fact the true dominion mandate that is explained in that we understand from the Book of Genesis, not the dominionist mandate that some people like to kind of propagate sometimes, and as you sort of alluded to earlier, where that trying to say, well, the church just needs to come up with a church that'll control everything. and all legal action, all whatevers. And that's not the way it's meant to be either. That's not the way God designed it as well. So I think it's interesting that that ultimately, you know, these sorts of ideas are very concordant together. The Christian idea that ends don't justify means, that all men are created equal, to borrow from a phrase there, that our moral standings before God are equal, that we will all answer for what we have done before God in the same way, that there's no way that you can hold an office, wear a uniform, be a CEO, or be whoever, and come up with a different standard of morality that you will answer to before God at the end of days, if you will. That's what we believe as Christians. Likewise, libertarians think that the standard of morals for everyone is identical, that you don't get a free pass because you're a government official, or you have some type of extra standing, or you have more money than somebody else does, that morality is consistent across the spectrum. That's what matters there. And so these are common grounds that even atheist libertarians and Christians who are libertarian as well can kind of recognize that, look, we do have a way that we can interact peacefully together and not be at each other's throats ever.
Yeah, and it takes the teeth out of things because you can
hopefully.
You know, if you take a let's take a divisive issue, let's say same-sex marriage, but 10 years ago, you know, if you are a Christian who doesn't believe that a gay couple should be married in your church, then fine, they can be married at the Episcopal church down the street. And you're not involved in any way, shape, or form because it's not a government function in any way, shape, or form either. So there really is no effect on your life. And if you have an opinion, stuff it. You know, because you're not involving the state in the marriage, you're not involving your church in the marriage, and they have an option to live their life as they see fit, and everyone goes home happy. You know, as opposed to what we have now, where when we evolve politics and everything, and the left certainly, I think, is so much, that's why they're so eager to get control of the Supreme Court, because they want to politicize every single aspect of society. And at least there are some Republicans that are libertarian leaning and just say, can we just have these few things that aren't politicized? There isn't the kind of rushing to battle when you're not involving the state. You know, you don't have to, when you're using the state to enforce your belief system on other people, they feel the need to fight back. And then eventually it just gets to a really ugly place, which is where I think we are now. That's the beautiful thing about libertarianism. And it just doesn't, you can live out your belief system and do the things that you'd like to do. And hey, if you want to be a libertine and you want to live life for pleasure only because you're not going anywhere, or if you want to live as, I don't know, a Mormon family of 19 and 19 kids, and you structure your world entirely around your church and your scripture, then so be it. You know, you're not forcing other people to live the way that you want to live. And so it kind of becomes that, we've said the word dominionist, but correct me if I'm wrong, if I say anything, but it basically is structuring the government to be a biblical government, almost like a Sharia law for Christians. You know,
that's one way of describing it,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah. It takes the, I think for the atheist libertarians who are like, oh no, the libertarian Christians are coming. It's like, yeah, but we're not going to use the state to make you become a Christian. We just want to live this way and you live that way and we're all good.
Well, in fact, we just say we wouldn't use the state.
Right.
Like, that's the whole point. And if I don't have the state to force you to do anything, then either I am thus a criminal for trying to force, you know, you at the point of a gun to do something, or I'm just trying to persuade you. And there's no limits on the efficacy of persuasion. In fact, that's what libertarians want to do when they try to make non-libertarians libertarians.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's the whole point, is that you have to persuade someone to adopt your viewpoint. So if libertarians are going to complain of Christians about doing something like that, well, then they have to kind of look in the mirror and go, well, what are we doing here?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's really any conflict there anymore if we then just exit the state from the scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think you kind of struck me. I just read a book recently by Matt Chandler, who is a great pastor out of Texas, and he wrote a book called Take Heart. And he basically talked about speaking from a place of courage and sharing your faith, because society is now structuring itself, and society is structuring itself in a post-Christian world, and you don't have the benefit of people just automatically being exposed to Christian ideas. You now have to persuade people, and it reminded me so much of libertarianism, because we haven't lived in a world where it's been automatic exposure to libertarian ideas. You have to go out and persuade people. But I've seen in the Christian world, Rob Dreher wrote a book called The Benedict Option. There are a lot of books coming out now where people... So what role do you think libertarians within the church can really help messaging within the Christian church because of our experiences of being in the wilderness for, all of human history?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because I'd kind of... I think there's probably some lessons to be learned going both directions. In fact, Christians can probably learn from libertarians about how to go and be bold in the presentation. Not in the way of the bullhorn guy, that classic, you know, the guy that shows up on your university campus with a bullhorn and yells at everybody and gets a lot of attention. That's not the boldness with courage presentation that I would think is important. But rather, you know, the idea that libertarians do have, you know, we have to go out there and be well-read, knowledgeable about what we're trying to say, and ready and willing to use effective rhetoric in the presentation of our ideas and to be persuasive. Okay. That's something that Christians can probably take heart from and learn from. Likewise, though, I think there's probably some ways in which libertarians can learn from Christian, insofar as it, you know, sometimes it is better to take the gentler approach, even when it is courageous in its approach and fully convinced, but being gentle in its presentation at times, that's something that Christians have kind of learned to do in many respects. At least that's something I've tried to do. And I think that there's a lot that, you know, a lot of lessons that libertarians can sometimes learn from that. Likewise, I think one lesson that libertarians can probably, you know, get from Christians is that gaining political power is not necessarily a good thing. Just as we talked about earlier, that one of the worst things ever that happened to the church was that unification of throne and altar again with Constantine. Just gaining, you know, your favored guy in that high spot of power is not exactly a true favorable scenario at times.
I've long said that the gay marriage debate completely destroyed the evangelical church as we know it, and the Republican Party in many ways.
Okay. Well, I mean, how do you mean, and what how would you explain that?
So, in terms of the power of the evangelical movement within the Republican Party, the Pat Robertson caucus that started in the 80s, that general structure of societal power, I guess, really kind of ran into a buzzsaw in the 2000s as gay marriage started to see a lot more acceptance in society, and it wasn't as much that they were saying that gay marriage was wrong. It was hypocrisy that really, I think, was the buzzsaw for the modern evangelical movement that kind of came out of the Billy Graham organization in the 50s and then, you know, coalescing around Jerry Falwell and the religious right. Maybe not the evangelical church, but the religious right and those associated. I think once they made the move into politics and tried to become more of a political force, a stricter standard was applied to many people, many of the leaders. And then once you get the Ted Haggards who are caught in, you know, doing cocaine with underage boys, then all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, all these people are just all hypocrites. And I noticed a very significant shift from my early days as a Christian to the end of the decade, from 2000 to 2010, in the attitude of society towards the Christian church at large because of politicization. They chose to make themselves a political force, and I think they paid a price.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. And that should, I mean, I think it kind of bolsters, well, you're lifting up all of this, and, you know, we're lifting each other up here.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to, you know, get at, which is that this, you know, the political power that we seek sometimes, well, maybe not that we seek, but that is sought at times is a true double-edged sword. And at the moment you get it, you may end up with a serious problem on your hands.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if Christians focus on a couple of different things, namely the presentation of the gospel to society and the promotion of true freedom, if you will, as a subsidiary thing to that, then our influence would probably rise, because there would be no impetus for, like, we're just trying to get into power so we can control what's going on, but rather we want people to live as they please, provided that they're not executing force against others. I mean, that's liberty. That's the libertarian idea as well, for that matter. It's just that it's got attached to it at that point, that we do that for the purpose of, as Christians at least, for the sake of Christ.
So what do you say to conservatives who say that if you're going to have societal order, there has to be a religious angle to it, or else you end up with hell on earth?
Yeah, so like that if you don't have the Christian backdrop there, you know, that there's just going to be a dissolution of society. I think it's kind of where you're going with that. And,
right.
And yeah, I mean, on some level, there's probably something to it, but not in the sense of that the state needs to be the one to maintain it. Because the state is a really bad propagator of culture. In fact, it's really the culture. It's the culture destroyer. From whether you're thinking about, you know, the exportation thereof, which, you know, destroys cultures through war and interventionism, or destroying the culture at home through its various ways of restricting action and trying to nudge people in various ways that may not necessarily be the right way of behaving, or the right way of really organizing each other. The thing is that I think Christianity inherently recognizes that voluntary action is the only way that we can truly organize society and have order. Let me restate that Christianity states that voluntary action is the only way that we can truly have, like, authentic order in society. Because if you have a society that is characterized by the oppression as its normative practice to getting what we want, then that is pure chaos. That negates the word anarchy at that point. I cannot go through my daily life without expecting aggression as being the normative measure of how things are done in the world, then I truly have a chaotic existence to live through. Christianity turns that on its head, and libertarianism also turns that on its head by saying that aggression is prohibited, that if we're going to interact together in peace, that it has to be through voluntary means. And so statism inherently turns things chaotic, and dare I say that more anarchical, in the negative sense of the word, way of looking at things. Not you know, as we understand, you know, ANCAP stuff, but true chaos is statism, and true chaos is where you allow for aggression to be the way that you're going to organize our interactions together.
Yeah, because true change.
So there's your religious basis there.
Yeah, I mean, true change really comes from within. You have to decide to get better. I mean, I didn't lose weight because someone put a gun to my head and told me I had to lose weight. I'm sure I would, but you know, in a free society, in terms of weight loss, for instance, like in America, you know, I had to choose to make a change in my life. I completely see what you're saying, because persuasion really comes about when the person accepts it inside of themselves. And decides to take charge of their own world and the world around them. And yeah, absolutely. That makes total sense. So
what Shapiro is saying there is essentially that there needs to be somebody to force people to behave in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be somebody who is able to force a particular moral standard that is over and beyond not aggressing against people.
Right.
And that, to me, is where it starts breaking down from a religious point of view, because from my Christian perspective, that is something I am prohibited from doing.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's kind of logically here, again, I'm kind of rehashing, but logically then, if I'm prohibited from doing that as a Christian, and I believe that God created this world to be its own self-sustaining thing, when people act morally and thus practically, that if you start incorporating aggression into that, flourishing diminishes.
Yeah, as absolutely. A rule. Right. Yeah. And it really stems from the, you know, becoming a, if you understand maybe you can kind of articulate this, and what it means exactly to become a Christian and kind of define that process, because I think that will help kind of give an idea to people who may not be a Christian, who don't understand quite what we're saying, and maybe put it in terms, more personal terms, the idea of accepting Christ within yourself. It's not that people are wanting society. Like, to me, I watched Braveheart today, and like, that wasn't a very, you know, maybe that was a Christian society run by the church, but that wasn't a very Christian universe, you know, like the state, right. The state was forcing itself on, you know, new wives and everything. Can you talk about the process of personal acceptance and that process of personal change as when you become a Christian?
Sure. Kind of, and I think the essential means, or the essential way of describing this, and I've used this word before, you know, just earlier in the podcast here, becoming a Christian means you are taking on the model of Christ. Being a Christian literally means being a little Christ, if you will. That's what the word Christian really kind of means here. And why do we care about that? Is that we are created in the image of God, and God wants us to be individuals, but also to maintain that image of Him in a certain way. And like, we're both individuals and yet part of Him. And that means that we take on who Jesus is as a model. And what I'd encourage anybody, if that intrigues you, start reading the Gospels and look at what Jesus says about how the world should be. And it's revolutionary when you think about it, because He exposes so much about who we are as human beings and how fallen that we really are in so many different ways. And His activity demonstrates this to us, and His ultimate persecution by the Jews and the Romans, and his death, burial, and resurrection demonstrates to us that, yeah, he's really here for the long haul, and he's the real deal. And so, to put it simply, like, taking that on as a model is the ultimate sense in which one becomes a Christian. Then part of that is, of course, being involved in the Christian community. And so, you know, again, if you're interested in that, read the Gospels and start talking to a church about it and what that should mean. And once you get to that point, then that's wonderful.
Yeah. Do you have any sort of specific denomination that you're affiliated with? Are you a broad organization? How does that work with the Libertarian Christian Institute?
Oh, so LCI itself, we are not involved with the denomination. We're a registered 501c3 organization. So we publish articles from all sorts of different sections of Christendom, from the Catholics and from the Greek Orthodox. We try to promote, you know, as many different perspectives out there as we can in that respect, just so that we can show people that this is not unique to any, just to Protestants or just to one denomination or just to Catholics or just to Orthodox, but this is something that we as Christians who fall under the Apostles' Creed, and that's what we believe about who Jesus is and who God is, that generic sense of being Christian is something that we all are part of that, and we all also agree with the ideas of liberty. Now, me personally, I'm part of the Churches of Christ, which I think has a wonderful kind of liberty heritage in many respects, which maybe sometime that's something else we could talk about, but it's a wonderful thing. And as many denominations have wonderful people in them who were adamant about liberty for people, for everyone, for the world. And so that we think that's an important thing to do and to represent in what we do.
Great. Well, is there a common question? Like, all right, so I was talking to somebody recently, and they were like, I did these videos because I was tired of answering the same question over and over and over. Is there like a question that you get all the time that you just are tired of answering because you get asked it so frequently?
Wow. Okay. Well, I think let's go with this, just the super common one. The probably the biggest question that you get, and this is the bugaboo question, is how do you interpret that nasty passage, Romans 13?
Okay. Explain
Romans
that.
Chapter 13. Yeah. It's that, it starts off and it says, you know, it's a the Apostle Paul is writing to the Roman church at the time and is saying, you know, basically that the state is ordained by God and so on and so forth. And it's there to bear the sword. And it makes some kind of statements that if on very cursory, plain reading might be kind of a justification for the state itself. And this becomes really nasty when certain authoritarian type leaders want to use it to quell opposition to their presumed authority. Even the likes of Adolf Hitler tried to use Romans 13 as to why Germany fall behind him and adhere to his rule, if you will. We've seen it even more recently, even 10 or 12 years ago in Zimbabwe, that one of their leaders tried to do that.
Didn't Jeff Sessions just do it like not even 2 months ago with
I was going to say that, like, this is hardly even 1 month ago when this started coming up with respect to the immigration restrictions and why, you know, why that was important to because some Christians were objecting to the breakup of families, you know, at the border, which, you know, is a pretty natural thing to do. You'd think that'd be a, you know, pretty heinous thing to do. But then Jeff comes in and says, well, you know, you Christians should just remember that Romans 13 is part of where we get our authority, essentially. It says that, you know, following the law is a good thing, blah, 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 blah. And look, that's not a very, very surface way of doing theology, and we definitely do not promote such things. In fact, really, you know, to answer the question in short, like, what does Romans 13 really mean? I think that the short way of answering that is that it was written to a particular people at a particular time, those being Roman Christians who were living under Nero, by the way. A lot worse than a Trump or Obama or Bush. We were talking frickin' Nero here, the guy who burned Christians at stakes and fed them to lions and things like that. So why is it that Paul would write that? Well, it might be because perhaps that people were getting confused in that, you know, their newfound freedom in Christ that they now believe that they had, and they did indeed have, should be used in such a way to say, like, well, we're going to stand up to him right now and not pay our taxes or you know, go up in resistance against him. That's what this means now, that for us. And in a sense, like, that's what Paul is reacting against, saying, no, wait a second, guys, your newfound freedom in Christ, which I just talked about in the previous couple chapters here, is really, you know, needs to be focused on spreading gospel as opposed to spreading resistance like that politically right now. And thus, you know, prudentially, what you should do is behave as reasonable citizens of your empire right now. Take it easy, guys. Don't just blend in per se, but don't come up in arms right now against this. But rather recognize what your true purpose is and act prudentially in the face of these overwhelming odds that you're never going to possibly be able to fully execute against. And so, you know, there's a big problem in the church today that kind of tries to use this as a proof text for statism while ignoring so many of other scriptures in the Bible that tend to criticize statism or criticizing the state in general and very specifically, both in a very direct sense and in a metaphorical sense. And there's really a huge problem in kind of tunnel visioning to Romans 13 rather than taking the whole counsel of scripture as your example there. And because really, you know, the state is maligned in scripture from the book of Genesis to the end, you know, in the beginning to the end, and all the way to the end in Revelation, where it's shown that its ultimate destiny is in destruction.
Right.
And so that's really important to remember. Now, that's sort of the short, you know, quick and dirty way of answering it. I go into a lot more detail in an article that you can Google at any time called New Testament Theology of the State. And if you look at libertarianchristians.com and find the articles called New Testament Theology of the State, that article, or it's a series of two articles, really, which is an award-winning article, by the way.
Where did what award?
Oh, well, I won a I wrote it in grad school, and I won a Christian Scholars Conference Award for best paper with it. So it's pretty cool. But that was way back. That was like over 10 years ago. So it doesn't really matter.
No. But always an award winner. It's like, I'm going to call you Mr. President if you're Bill Clinton, even though it's been 20 years.
Well, I guess that makes sense. But I'd still say my dissertation on polymers was better. But, you know, that's a whole other story. Nonetheless, if you Google libertarianchristians.com New Testament theology of the state, you'll find this. And I address in that article or series of articles a few different passages that are really important to understanding truly how to kind of approach a theology of the state in the scriptures, namely Matthew chapter 5 and the temptations of Jesus. And then Matthew 21 and rendering unto Caesar, that passage, and then Romans 13 finally, and really trying to approach, and that's not even like the complete way of doing it. That's like the shorthand way is addressing those three passages in the New Testament. But you know, we haven't even gotten into the Old Testament yet. And so, that's a whole nother story. So there's a lot of good Bible that you can bring to bear in understanding why the state is so horrible. And you know, from Genesis in chapter 9 all the way to Revelation, and so you know, you can, and I would encourage anybody to join up with our website, you know, get on our mailing list and start perusing around and our resources there, learn all that we have to say about that, I write some pretty good stuff, but we got a lot of really good people write for us.
If I were to do that, at what URL should I visit?
Well, I would go to www.libertarianchristians.com.
Okay.
And definitely look for, you know, on the front page, the Get Started Here button, because that's a great way to kind of overview some of this stuff. And if you find that, you'll find those New Testament theology of the state and various other things, too, that'll be helpful.
What is the name of your podcast? And what kind of things do you how's your podcast structured? What do you talk about? And where can people find that?
Oh, cool. Yeah. So, yeah, we do have a podcast. It's just called The Libertarian Christian Podcast. And it's you know, it's listed on iTunes and you can find it there. Or if you use Android and you use like Podcast Addict or Stitcher or whatever, you can find it through searching around there. No problem. We're everywhere. Or you can just go to our website and download episodes individually at the pages that are in. So we have four different people who are kind of rotating in and out as our host, and that includes me, Doug Stewart, Nick Gosling, and then Jason Rink, who I think you may know. And we do a bunch of different formats as well. We've done Q&A type episodes, and we've done interviews. We do just pure discussions where we take a topic and we dissect it and go through a bunch of different, you know, ways of thinking about it. And, you know, and then, of course, we do a bunch of different things. We even have rehashed some of our old presentations and done like kind of annotated editions of some of our Christians for Liberty conference speeches and, you know, things like that as well. And so it's a great thing. We've been running it now for just about a year and a half. And it's been super fun to do. We've really enjoyed putting it together for everybody, and it's only going to continue. We put out an episode roughly once a week, and it usually shows up on Monday or Tuesday, one or the other.
All right, cool. So where can people follow you personally? I'm sure that people have a ton of questions or knowing my audience criticisms.
Oh, that's okay. You know, I take it in stride.
So if people want to write you and get in touch with you, or if you send it to editor@wearelibertarians.com, I can forward it to them. But yeah, I mean, how can people follow you? Where can they get in touch with you? And how can they interact with the Libertarian Christian Institute?
Well, there's a few different ways. Of course, we've got our website is our primary, is libertarianchristians.com. We're all over social media. We have our Libertarian Christian Institute page, which I think is just facebook.com/libertarianchristians. And we post a lot of different stuff there, just sharing articles. We share our own material. We share others. We do memes and have a lot of fun and try to cause a lot of trouble as well. We have our massive Facebook group, which I mentioned earlier, has about 8,000 people in it, really of a variety of different backgrounds, and both religious and libertarian wise. So it's a great place to learn. We get we talked about other questions that get rehashed over and over again. You'll usually find those happening once a week over there. And that's great. It's a great place to learn. And then you can find us on Twitter as well at LCI Official. which that's our main Twitter page. You can also just find me at Norman Horn. I'm not super active on Twitter, but if you mention me, I'll try to respond as timely as I can. I'm not always very good about that. But if you do find our page on Facebook, that's usually a pretty good way of catching us. We're very responsive to questions on there. And also, you know, you can contact us at libertarianchristians.com/contact, and you can message us from there as well. So there's a bunch of different ways you can reach us, and we encourage you to do that if you have questions or would like to get involved somehow.
Awesome. Well, I will definitely. I think I might be in there, but I'm going in there to check out the memes. So,
yeah, you'll see some fun ones.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me. This was a great conversation. I'd love to have you back sooner rather than later, and talk about some more stuff. And I really appreciate you coming on and taking the time.
Oh, Chris, it's my honor. I'm definitely pleased to be here. Thanks for having me on, man. It's been really fun.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, and we will see you in just a couple days.